Welcome, fellow seekers of the extraordinary, to our shared quest to understand how we can achieve our fullest potential. May we always have the courage and wisdom to learn from those who have something to teach. Join me now in Seeking the Extraordinary.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Seeking the Extraordinary. Michael Nathanson has been kind enough to share the host mic with me today. I'm Christina Saunders, Senior Portfolio Manager at the Colony Group. Today's episode is sponsored by Her Wealth by Colony. Her Wealth is committed to empowering women with the tools and resources they need to make informed financial decisions and take control of their wealth. I'm so pleased to have our guest on today's episode. She's the Senior Vice President of Science and Health Policy for Healthy Women, a nonprofit organization dedicated to educating women to make informed health choices. She was the former president and CEO of the Society for Women's Health Research, a national nonprofit organization widely recognized as the thought leader in women's health research for the last 26 years. Her passion and commitment for raising awareness about the need for equity in women's healthcare research is reflected in her life's work. In 2016, she was given the Trailblazer Award by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Women's Health. She's been selected for numerous other recognitions over the course of her career, including one of the 20 most influential women in medicine today and 50 women who are changing the world. This is just to name a few. The list is long. Most recently, she was the recipient of the Women in Government Relations Lifetime Achievement Award, and she just published an extraordinary book, Sex Sells: The Fight to Overcome Bias and Discrimination in Women's Healthcare. Today, you'll hear about her background, the challenges she faced during her career, and the motivation that drives her. Please join me in welcoming Phyllis Greenberger. Welcome, Phyllis.
Thank you so much, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, it's so good to have you here, and the topic is so important. And as I mentioned in the intro, you know, your life's work has been this mission. And so I think it's really important to talk about, and your book is I think, first of all, it's a great book. Congratulations. I had the opportunity to read it before I got an advanced copy. So thank you for making that happen. But so, you know, Sex Sells, you know, seems to be, you know, the culmination of your life's work. So what prompted you to write the book?
I just felt that it was my life's work. I felt that it was, you know, very important that people should understand sort of, you know, where we were and the accomplishments we have made. But also, I'm hoping that the book will stimulate more interest and more research. It's interesting, you may be aware of this, that Jill Biden just announced a women's health research initiative. I mean, that's a great thing, but certainly taken a long time. And I have obviously some thoughts about how that should be used, because just having more money for research is not necessarily the answer. It's how the research is conducted. But I just felt after I had accomplished this, and I just felt, you know, this was an important story. People needed to know, because this was serious, and it was really sort of stunning how difficult it was to actually accomplish most of what I've done.
Yeah, definitely saw that, you know, in the arc of the story in the book, which we'll get to some of these particular things, specifics about that. But I thought it'd be great to kind of start at the beginning of your kind of re-entry into the workforce. You know, I guess you were at the American Psychiatric Association. You interned there. Is that when you were in graduate school?
Yeah, I was getting my master's in social work, and I was thinking about this. It was such a long time ago. It was the father of one of my oldest son's best friend's father was a lawyer for the APA. Okay. And I was over there, I don't know, for some reason, I don't remember what it was. And that was when I was in graduate school. And at the time, I thought I wanted to do therapy, but then I was thinking about maybe policy. And he said that he was actually a lawyer for the APA. And if I wanted an internship there, you know, perhaps he could help me. So that's how that started. And so I was there. And this was kind of funny. I was there as an intern, obviously. So I was only
all
there.
All right. So how old were you now? You're called an intern. At what age were you? Because you already had three kids. But
I already had three kids. So I had my first. Jesus. I must have been in my late 20s, I guess.
Okay.
20s, okay. Early 30s. And I was only there for a couple of days because I had to go to school, you know, the rest of the time. And there was an opening for a lobbyist that I wanted to, that I was interested in becoming at the time. And he said, so I went in to speak to him and he said, well, you know, you're only here 3 days a week. And I can't believe that I said this. I said to him, I can do in 3 days what anybody else can do in 5 days. I can't believe that puts me to say that, but I did. And of course, it was only 3 days until the end of the semester, and I can't remember when it was, but it may have been, you know, a month or so before the end of the semester, at which point I could work full time. So it was just working part time, you know, for those few days.
Yeah.
So that's how that started. So it was all about connections as everything.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, so, you know, obviously at that time, it wasn't always easy to come. So, yeah, I mean, the networking, the connections got you kind of your foot into the door
right
there. And yeah, but what were some of the challenges that you faced? Maybe not just there, but early on as you were kind of reentering the workforce, what were some of the challenges that you faced?
Well, the good news and the bad news. The bad news is that I got the chicken pox along with my three sons. This was before the vaccination, and we really had it badly. And my mother, I'm from Brooklyn. You could probably tell that right away, right? My mother asked there was a woman that was taking care of an aunt of mine who passed away. And my mother asked her if she would come to Washington and take care of me while I was sick and the kids were sick. And she did, and she never left. So she stayed for about 13 years. So obviously that made my life a lot simpler. So I had actually someone helping to take care of the kids. And so then I was able to go back to school, and I was able to eventually, obviously, go to work.
Yeah.
And my husband was very supportive. There were, you know, no issues there. And so, you know, I look back on it and I say, you know, it's hard to remember exactly how it was, but I managed to do it. And then, of course, as we'll get to, one thing led to another. And then, of course, as the kids were in school full time, then, of course, it was much easier. And then she was still there as well. So when they got home, you know.
Yeah.
So I was okay with that. And had I not gotten the chicken pox, I don't know if she ever would have come.
Right.
Who knows? So
it's a silver lining to the chicken pox. Yeah.
Right.
So while you kind of state in your book that, you know, you noticed when you were at the, you know, American Psychiatric Association is where you started to hear about the lack of females in clinical trials. And that's when you really became engaged in this subject, and that your journey, basically the arc of your career, essentially paralleled the beginnings of this acknowledgement that change needed to happen. And I noticed really in the book that even though it got acknowledged at that point that, hey, something's off here, that all research is essentially being done on men versus women, there was an acknowledgement, but it took a long time for change to actually come. And you kind of described that part of your journey kind of really paralleled that. So can you discuss, you know, essentially how you moved from the American Psychiatric Association to the Society for Women's Health and how that part of, you know, how that shift happened? And
sure. So because when I went back to school and was interning and then working at the APA, I was older than a lot of the staff. And so I became friendly with the women psychiatrists. Some of them, you know, I was closer in age to the women psychiatrists and became friendly with them. And I heard from them about the fact that not only about clinical trials, and I'm not even sure I knew what clinical trials were at that point, but that women were sort of being neglected in terms of tenure and publishing. And then I don't know whether it was clinical trials or whether just talking about, you know, studying women. But as we all know, then and now, women suffer more from depression and anxiety than men do. And so the lack of attention on women in those conditions, obviously, was a topic of conversation. And how I got into it was also sort of, you know, you never could plan these things in advance. So I got very friendly with these women psychiatrists. And one of them that I was particularly friendly with invited me to go to a meeting And it was a meeting of, I don't know if it was just psychiatrists. I think it was, you know, a combination of other doctors, researchers, whatever. And it was all about HIV/AIDS. Now, this was the very beginning of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, the very beginning. And the discussion was about the fact that they were testing and diagnosing men and pregnant women, but nobody was looking at women. It was either prenatal or men. And as it turned out later, the fact is that women obviously got AIDS, but also had different symptoms and needed different treatment. But that was still to come. So while I was at that meeting, I was talking to another, actually she was OBGYN, and they were putting together a nonprofit society. It was called the Society for the Advancement of Women's Health Research initially, and they were putting together this volunteer board to look at women's health issues. And one, the reason was that she was at the Institute for Children and Maternal Health at NIH, and she was concerned and realized that The focus was on children and on maternal health, but there was no research or very little attention to other conditions that affected women. So she put together this volunteer board, and the board was all researchers, scientists, doctors. And she asked, and I was talking to her, and obviously, as you said, I was a lobbyist for the APA. I knew all the pharma companies because of the political action committees and all the networking and stuff. I was very friendly with several members of Congress, particularly women members of Congress, because when I was running the APA's PAC, I was giving most of the money to women who were running, which was also unique because, you know, we know there were very few women then, and mostly they didn't get the support that the men did. So I became very friendly with them, and my husband was a journalist. And so I knew people in the media, both journalism and television. And then he asked me to be on the board because I knew Washington. I mean, they didn't know Washington. They knew research and science and, you know, they were brilliant, but, you know, they didn't know how to get things done. So I got on the board, and then what happened was I volunteered to work for the Clinton campaign, and I got friendly with Hillary, and I did women's health for the Clintons, and I also did, because I was at the APA, I did the mental health issues for Tipper, because that was her, and then I got, when Clinton, this is in the book, I think you probably read it, when Clinton gave his address at the dinner after the inauguration, he mentioned women's health. And Hillary came over to me and said, that was because of you.
Wow.
So, you know, one thing sort of led to another. I mean, nothing was planned. Just everything was just spontaneous.
I know. So just for clarity, how long were you at the APA that you developed all these amazing relationships, really, while you were there? How long were you there?
Geez, I don't even know. I left there in, I guess I started the society, I think, in 90. So I don't know, maybe at 20, I don't know how many years, probably about, I can't even remember. It was a long time ago.
But I mean, obviously you were there for a long enough period of time to have developed right. All these relationships.
Well, yes. And it was really, you know, the political action committees were very different than they are now. You had whenever you were running, you had an event then. You had one a year or one every couple of years. It wasn't like now where it's forever. And also you were very limited by the amount of money that you could give. It was much more humane at the time. But I got friendly with about five or six women, to the point where they'd come over to my house, we'd have dinner, you know, I mean, it was, so there was sort of rights of the taking, you know.
Yeah,
So after after Clinton said that, and then they asked me, and I was involved, I don't know if this is even in the book, they asked me about the breast cancer walks, which never had been in Washington before, and I said that, you know, I agreed that they should have them, and I just got involved in a lot of issues. So I went back to the board and I said, you know, I think now that women's health is more in the forefront and that people are paying attention to it, I think we need to start a real organization, not just a volunteer organization, that we need to get staff, we need to raise money, we need to, you know, really get into it. So they agreed. And then, of course, they did a search for about 6 months, and they ended up with me. So, yeah, they ended up with me. And I remember, and I don't know if this is in the book, I remember coming home from work and saying to my husband, well, I have good news and I have bad news.
Yes, it's in the book.
The good news is that I'm now the president of the Society for the Advancement of Women's Health Research. And the bad news is there is no money, no stamp, or no office. Well, so that's another whole story. So, and that's how we started, how we got going. So a lot of it had to do with my working on the Clinton campaign and with Hillary. So, you know, it's interesting how one thing leads to another.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you have a mad skill set for sure, Phyllis. It just happened. But so why don't we get into a little bit of the book and some of the issues that you raise? What do people need to understand about the concept of males, men, and females, women are equal, but they are not the same as it pertains to healthcare?
Well, the reason that phrase came up was this was the beginning of the National Organization of Women and some of the other women's organizations, the ERA, et cetera. And there was this sort of push to show that women, you know, should have power, women should be treated equally. Of course, that's been going on forever. And so there was pushback. So that, you know, here I was coming out saying that women were different. Well, they were all saying, you know, we're all equal, okay?
Wow.
So that's how that phrase came out. We're equal. So, we are equal. We should be treated equally, but that doesn't mean we're the same.
Right.
And that's how that sort of, so that was a real push. I remember having to testify on the Hill, and this is another story about, you know, there were the women's groups that didn't want women in clinical trials, thought it would be dangerous.
Really? I had no idea.
I mean, you know, that book could have been twice as long. But so there was a lot of pushback.
A second book to write.
Yeah, right. I'm not too old for that, but, right. I just, you know, there were a lot of stories in there. And one of the things that's funny about it is that, you know, there were some sort of negative things I could have said about some people in high power. And the publisher, you know, wanted me to sort of tone that down. They didn't want to sort of antagonize anybody. But at any rate, so there's a lot more behind the scenes, you know. But at any rate, so we had to sort of convince women's organizations, you know, here they were trying to convince everybody that women were equal, and now we were saying they weren't the same. So it really is sort of remarkable because the bottom line, well, there were, I think, three major issues. One is that basically people thought that men and women were the same, except for their reproductive organs. Secondly, there was this tradition, obviously, of doing clinical trials in penal institutions or the military where there were no women. And the third, and in those days, you know, you didn't find out if you were pregnant, I don't know, until the rabbit died or something. Remember that? So they were afraid that if they had women in clinical trials and they were pregnant, and then, of course, this is a real, you know, issue, and it is still an issue now.
And it is an issue. That's a reasonable concern.
It is an issue now. But that's another explanation that there's justification for it. But I don't know if you want to get into that. But anyway. So those were the basic reasons why women weren't in clinical trials.
Right. So there wasn't this big evil overlord that was keeping women out of the research. I think that's important to understand. Obviously, there were women that didn't want this to happen. But in terms of how testing was done, that's just kind of how it was done. And nobody thought that there were necessarily differences. This is going back many years. So
Right.
So you agree with that. Okay.
Yeah. No, I think, I mean, if the history in the book, I mean, going back 1,000 years, of course, is that, you know, that's another whole story about how they treated
women.
That's
another book, Phyllis.
Right. Well, that was, they thought, you know, women were just their, basically their uterus, you know, and they weren't good for anything else. But so there were some, you know, legitimate reasons, and it never really occurred to anybody.
Nobody thought about it. Right. So one of the things you point out is that lab research was mostly and still mostly done on male animals, which is interesting because, you know, as a normal person who's not involved in healthcare, it wouldn't have even occurred to me that that would matter. But you bring that up several times in the book. And you also bring up, even though changes have been made, you know, in terms of how clinical studies are done, it's still that even though the study is being done, the data that comes from it is not being applied to the differences between the sexes. Why would that be? Is that a cost issue? Is that...
I think there's a number of issues. You know, now, we want to have, and we talk about diversity as well. So, you know, the book really is it was initially focused on women, but we're also talking about Black women and Hispanic women and some minority issues. So I think, you know, I mean, it was difficult to get women in clinical trials because of childcare and travel. And then, you know, just especially in some populations where men don't want their women to be in situations like that. But it was, remind me of the question again. There was...
No, just in terms of, you mentioned in the book a couple of times that even though there are clinical trials that on men and women, the data that comes from that trial is not then used.
Right. Okay. So the reason is that, first of all, it's difficult to get the clinically relevant numbers in clinical trials so that you have enough women and enough men and enough minorities, depending upon what the trial is, to have it clinically relevant to those populations. The second thing is that, and as a non-scientist, I can't explain this any further than this, but I've been told that when the researchers or principal investigators formulate the trial, they need to have in their formulation before the trial how they're going to analyze the differences, whether it's sex differences or ethnic differences, and most don't do that. So you can, now again, I can't tell you why, but only that once you have the trial completed, you can't go back and see why there were differences. You can see that, I mean, so that's another problem. That is still a problem. The other thing is, and I just learned this the other day, one of the things that we were able to accomplish was to have the FDA have on their website, as therapeutics were approved, what the combination of participants were. So how many women, how many men, were there Blacks, Hispanics, whatever. Inevitably, there was never 50%. You know, there were always men outnumbering the women. So the good news was you could look at that. Of course, nobody knew that they were even on the website. So they sort of, the only thing they satisfied the FDA's requirements, but they didn't do anything for the individual who wanted to see how the trial was, because they wouldn't know it was there anyway. So you now had snapshots of the research and who was in it, but there was no analysis. So what did that mean? So now, which is interesting to me, and I wrote a blog on this, the one thing that COVID did, two things that COVID did that was really positive was they started talking about clinical trials because nobody knew about what a clinical trial was. In fact, when I was at the society, we did one of these, stop people on the street. We did a sort of a tongue-in-cheek video about asking people if they knew what a clinical trial was. And nobody knew what a clinical trial was. And this is Washington. I mean, we're not talking about some... and so the COVID, I think, educated people about the fact that what a clinical trial was. And also what was interesting, although I'm not sure they know why, is that men would suffer differently. Women would, you know, there'd be differences for men and women.
Interesting.
I don't know, though there's been actually very recent research on some autoimmune issues with women. I mean, I think finally that people are looking at these issues, but there's still no explanation. So if women get long COVID more than men, why is that? If men get COVID more than women, why is that? So we now know, I mean, there clearly are differences, but we need to figure out what the differences are. Do the medications have to be different? I work closely with Sabra Klein from Johns Hopkins, and she has been doing research on the flu vaccine for, I don't know, 10 years, showing that women have more side effects from the flu vaccine than men do, and also they need a smaller dose. So if you give women a smaller dose, first of all, you have more vaccine left over for other people, and second of all, they don't have the side effects. So this is basic stuff.
This is critical. Right. Yeah. Right. I'm going to bring up, just because you put it in the book and it's a name that everyone's going to realize now that you've brought up the COVID conversation, that you have Dr. Fauci. You met him many years ago and tried to get him on board with some of this stuff and just didn't have any interest. Yeah.
Well,
yeah. But anyway.
And even the two of us, this was also got a long time ago, two of us gave a plenary speech at the Aspen Institute. And he at the time was all about AIDS because that was his issue then. And I talked about, obviously, sex differences. And this was really at the beginning. But he just sort of blew me off. I mean, it was like, you know, it wasn't even a thought process in him.
Yeah. He was among the many that blew you off. So we won't.
Along with everybody else. Right. Well, they blew me.
All right. Well, let's get into some of the disparities that women do face in medical treatments. And, you know, you point out a couple of them. But there was one point in the book, I literally fell out of my chair when I read this, that hysteria as a diagnosis was dropped from the APA's Bible or whatever it's called in 1980. Like the catch-all for every female ailment was hysteria.
Right.
I literally almost fell out of my chair. And I'm like, what? Like, how could that be?
Well, this is sort of, you know, it's all in your head sort of thing.
I mean, it was just it's really kind of very surprising. But anyway, as I was reading the book, you know, I extrapolated kind of two themes that you were talking about. One was, you know, what you're calling, I think you called it bikini medicine, which was, you know, represents really female issues at the end of the day, you know, and then all of the other issues that both men and women face, but that obviously the treatment should be different based on all the work that you've done. So I thought maybe we could start with heart disease and what you've seen there in terms of.
Well, I think I knew you were going to say heart disease. I'm very amused.
We can start wherever you want. If you don't want to.
I think heart disease is a good one because I had to convince the American Heart Association that women had had cardiovascular issues. Okay. I'm much older than you are, but I remember, I mean, men were supposed to shovel walks because they can have a heart attack. That was sort of, you know, big thing then. And it was all about men. There was no mention, no consideration of women having heart disease. And I remember going over to the AHA and trying to convince them. We had started then, during that time, I was working with this woman whose daughter was in the modeling and the garment industry. And we were going to work with NHLBI, which is the National Institute for Heart, Lung, and Blood. And we were going to start a campaign educating women on heart disease. This was called Red Dress. And I went to the AHA, asked them to be part of it. You know, there wasn't any interest. And then a couple of years after that, they actually copied the model. They now use it. It's called Go Red. They've copied the whole thing that we did, and now they've taken ownership as if it was the right idea. That's another thing. So the bottom line is that women, and this is obviously in the book, they have different symptoms, not all the time, but a lot of the time. Very often they're brushed off, they're sent home, you know, you have indigestion or, you know, you're depressed or whatever. So the signs were different. There's one kind that I'm not even very familiar with called SCAD, which is predominantly a woman's heart condition. And there's, a patient discussion in the book about that. They started a nonprofit around that. And then I helped actually at the same time with a friend of mine who I guess she was in her 40s, middle 40s, had a heart attack, contacted the AHA and asked if they had a support group for women, which of course they did not. And they, you know, told her they didn't. So she came to me and asked me to help her start a women's heart group. And so we started Women Heart, which is now, you know, up, I mean, she's not there anymore. She actually lives in Seattle. But it is basically, it's a support group and educational group for women with heart disease. So to talk about prevention and also treatment, and also for them to, it's nationwide. And
oh, that's great. And that's also gives them, you know, things that they can talk to their doctor about if the doctor is somewhat dismissive, right? Is that the goal? Yeah.
Right. So, you know, again, one thing just led to another. I mean, if she hadn't had the heart attack, which she comes to me, would we have started Women Heart? You know, maybe somebody would have later on, but it just, we're still in touch. I think she quoted in the book. Yeah. I mean, there were.
So heart disease, obviously many differences between men and women. Neurological issues associated with pain, migraine headaches tend to be more women, female oriented issues.
Right.
What were the findings there in terms of the work you've done?
Just with this, there was a doctor out in, I think, California, Dr. Cahill, who did, obviously was a neurologist, and he, you know, was, I don't know what kind of research he was doing when he discovered this, but realized that women, of course, I thought this was kind of funny because, you know, we know men and women's brains are different. I mean, you know, give me a break. I mean, that's pretty obvious, right? But they were really different in terms of migraines, in terms of pain, in terms of I can't give you the scientific.
And but.
But they are different in almost every way. So they have to be treated differently. And also, which I get into the book a little bit too, is devices. You know, I was on a device board. I was the only woman and all the other all men, and they were all either CEOs or, you know, high-powered men in all these device companies, and they were making hips and knees based on the male's anatomy.
Right.
Now, I mean, you don't have to be a genius to figure out.
No rocket scientist necessary.
Right. So it's about devices as well. And I remember being, it was just funny how you can picture certain things in your life. I was in Indiana for a book, I gave a presentation, and there was I can't remember the name of it, but there's a privately owned device company in Indiana. And I was I was talking to one of the researchers, and he was telling me that one of the devices that they produced didn't work as well in women as in men. And it had something to do with arteries. But they weren't telling people that. They just, you know, I guess they were afraid to say anything because they'd lose half their population. And then there's another device company that I got very friendly with ahead of it. And it turned out that their particular device worked better in women than men. So, you know, so if you really look, you know, if they look at it, may not happen 100, you know, across the board and everything, but every time I brought the subject up and talked to people about it, it was, oh, yeah, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the companies now, you know, are coming out, obviously, it's different now. I don't know. And it was just actually just last year, the CEDAR came out with a paper about how they now are going to have women in device trials. And that's relatively new. That's only within the last year or so.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing, Phyllis.
So, and I was on a coalition of interventional cardiologists through AdvaMed, which is the Association for Device Manufacturers. And of course, they were all women on this. I think they were all women. And one of the problems, and I think I mentioned this earlier, was the women are not being asked to be in trials for cardiovascular devices. And part of it still is. And they did research on this. And I wish I had the numbers. And it was in the last 3 years, let's say, about male cardiologists still not recognizing the fact that women have heart disease. Yeah. So there's still, you know, it used to be, I was talking to someone the other day, used to be you'd want to go to an older physician because you figured they had more experience.
Yeah.
But now they could need to go to a younger physician.
Yeah.
Because the old way just doesn't work anymore. I mean,
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And I still
and so, yeah. You know, just not to interrupt you, but I don't want to run out of time. And, you know, the notion of women's issues specifically, right? Issues that are very specific to women. When I went to one of the Healthy Women galas, this was probably 2 or 3 years ago, where they had a presenter who was talking about menstruation. And it was just such an eye-opening talk. My daughter and I left, and we were just like, how is it that half of our population goes through this every month? And there's been virtually no research done on, you know, problem solving in this particular space. Can you talk a little bit about that and what's in the works there, if anything?
Well, actually, it's interesting you mentioned that. That's not really obviously an area that we focused on for obvious reasons, although it was important in terms of research. And that's one of the reasons, as we discussed earlier, that women weren't in clinical trials. And also, what's happened, and the other issue we haven't really gotten into that is animal cells and animals. And also, turns out that female mammals are more expensive than male mammals. And of course, they have cycles and so that's part of that reason. But what's interesting is in the last 2 years, there's been a lot of focus on menstruation. There's actually ads on television about it, I mean, which you would never have had years ago. And there's a group, actually, she's distantly related. She's in Europe, but the group is located in Manhattan. It's called Alloy, Alloy, and that's all it's about is menstruation. So it's out in the open now. It's like the way, you know, cancer was never mentioned,
way back.
You didn't talk about menstruation. Now, all of a sudden, there is talk about it. So there is research. And there is a lot of focus on it. I mean, Healthy Women does focus on it as well.
Yeah.
And Alloy, it's one of their issues, but Alloy it's their issue. So for people that are listening to this podcast, if that's an issue that they're concerned about, they ought to Google it because
that and menopause, you know, all of these things that women deal with that men don't.
Right.
And that has not been the focus, like you said, of your work. And yet this whole other area that we're not even talking about, there's very little work.
Yeah. No, I meant menopause, not just menstruation. I meant menopause. There's a lot of focus on menopause now, which is relatively new. When I see an ad on television and it's on, I mean, regularly, it's, you know, that never would have happened 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, probably.
All right. So one of the things I wanted to ask you is just related to, you know, you obviously... you're a master networker, you're a master fundraiser, you're fabulous at many things, but these two particular areas have really kind of gotten you where you are. And so what would you share with younger women that, you know, how do you become a good networker? How do you become a good at raising funds and not feeling intimidated? What's your secret?
You know, it's funny because I get asked that a lot. You know, I started my younger years being very shy. I'm not sure how I had the nerve to do what I did, but I can't really answer that. All of a sudden, my personality changed. I mean, I remember when I started working at the Society and I went to an event, a friend of mine held it for me on Long Island, and I talked about the Society, I talked about our work, but I didn't ask for money. And she got up there and asked everybody to contribute. And I realized after that, if you don't ask, you don't get. And so, and then I don't know, I was sort of mastered in a way of asking for money that didn't turn people off and that lets the door open, you know, for another round. And my husband, you know, we'd go to an event and he said, so you better watch your wallet. Here she comes, you know. and they laughed and they knew that's what she does. But I delivered. I mean, if you gave us money to do a program, we did the program. We didn't do it, you know. But one of the things, and so I sort of learned how to do it. Don't ask me how. I mean, it wasn't like I had any teaching, but I do remember one instance where someone was asking me for money for, you know, not that it had nothing to do with the health issues, had something else, and was really obnoxious about it. And kept just made me very uncomfortable. And I realized, I mean, that was just, and never forgot it. you know? And I realized that there's a way to do things, you know, so that you don't turn people off. And then, you know, so when I go to an event, I was at an event last night, I start walking towards, especially these guys, you know, who are at these comedies, and oh, here she comes, you know. I can't explain how I got the nerve to do it, but
what would a request look like? You requesting somebody for money, what would that look like? Where you say you leave the door open?
Well, initially, I mean, I don't know, I don't want to mention any names, but obviously I am friendly, but I was even more friendly. You know, I've sort of peaked down. So I used to be friendly with the CEOs of pharma companies.
Yeah.
Now they're all different. I mean, they've all retired. I'm still hanging out here. But so I asked some guy from one of the companies to fund something. And he said, well, you know, I don't know. I said, well, just, you know, just think about it, you know, and then the next time I saw him, you know, sort of, and by the third time he said yes. So I didn't say, oh, you know, push it. I just, it was very easy about it because I figured he knows me. He knows what I do.
Yeah.
If he can do it, he will. And if he can't do it, you know, maybe another time. So, you know, I get asked this a lot and I can't really explain it. And I must say that I grew into it. Certainly at the beginning was really very hesitant about it. And I mean, if you don't do it, I mean, you know, as I said, I didn't have an office. I didn't have staff. I didn't have anything. I mean, the good thing about working for the APA and running the political action committees going back 40 years or whatever, 50 years, is that so all the fundraisers and the political action committee events that I went to were health related. So I knew all the people from the hospital association and the different pharma companies. And so when I needed money for this, I knew the people. And one of the other things that was interesting is that there were a lot of the representatives of the pharma companies were in D.C., even if the pharma companies were in New Jersey or someplace else. And when I would speak to the representatives, it never occurred to them as women that women weren't in clinical trials.
Wow. And
I think they convinced their, you know, the heads of their companies or their bosses to, so I think part of that had to do with women working in the pharma companies that realized that all the work that they were doing wasn't with women. And I do think that that had was something that really spurred people on, because it would have been difficult. I mean, just go to a pharma company and say, hey, can I have money for this?
Well, you also said in the book that, you know, having women rise up as doctors and moving into these different professions over time certainly helped the situation, right? Because, you know, 40 years ago, everything was male dominated. That's how it was. That was the reality. So listen, I could talk to you for like hours and hours and hours.
You know, I know. I hope I gave you enough information, right?
Well, we're going to make sure everyone buys your book.
I leave you with one saying. I mean, it's not over yet. Okay.
No, I know. So we're going to go into the extraordinary teachings segment. But before we do that, quickly, tell me what you're advocating for now and what still needs to be done.
Well, I mean, everything needs to be done. I mean, there has to be, I was at this was years ago at Mayo, about medical school curriculum. I'm assuming that that's all different now. It's certainly at the time, you know, there were no sex differences taught. I mean, and now I don't know whether it's for everybody or whether it's just, and of course, there are a lot of researchers and doctors that I worked with who work at various institutions around the country. So, but I do think in terms of the analysis, that's still, you know, that's still a problem. This new initiative by the White House, which of course is they're designating $100 million, which is obviously great, but I think, and I had conversations with the head of the Office of Women's Health at the NIH. She and I have gotten very friendly, obviously, and I do think there needs to be a structure when we started doing this at the Society and we were asked about whether we wanted to create an institute, because there's an institute for heart, lung, and blood, for neurology, for mental health, et cetera. And we specifically didn't want to, because we felt that if we segregated women's health into a separate area, then that would let the other institutes off the hook and they wouldn't have they wouldn't have to do research in women's health. But we've sort of changed our minds in a way, because there's really very little integration and cooperation among the various offices of women's health. And we're thinking about, and I'm not going to be able to do this, I mean, Congress is going to have to do it with the NIH, is having some sort of something in between, some sort of a center, so that it would coordinate and integrate the research that's going on, but it wouldn't say, okay, cancer institute, you don't have to look at breast cancer anymore. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So okay. We need to find a way that it can be integrated more, and I don't even think, frankly, $100 million is all that much. You know, here we are.
Yeah, I know, it's almost like a drop in the bucket, right?
I mean, we're talking about sex differences, obviously, for obvious reasons, but you know, women's had fibroids and endometriosis forever, and we don't have cures or treatments.
Yeah. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
A lot. And I still think there's discrimination against women doctors, against women scientists. It's still a problem, too.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate you bringing this to the fore. So we're going to go into our extraordinary teaching segment here.
Okay.
Ready?
Seeking the Extraordinary presents Extraordinary Teachings. A deeper look at the qualities that allow people to do extraordinary things.
All right, so Phyllis, first question. What's been your most satisfying accomplishment in life so far?
Aside from my kids, I guess my book.
Your book, okay. Okay. Any regrets?
No. I should have written the book a lot earlier, but I mean, obviously the book's not my greatest. The greatest, you know, success is what I accomplished. Mm-hmm. And the book is just to educate people about, you know, about the issue and why it's
a journey. Yeah.
So being able to, I mean, when I look back on it and think about, you know, all the guys and everything that I had to go, and women, you know, at the beginning, I wonder myself how I managed to do it, but I did it. So,
So what single tip would you offer that has helped you be your most extraordinary self?
I would say, don't say no. Don't take no for an answer. Just keep pushing. Again, I think that what I mentioned about raising money, I think you just have to do it in a way that doesn't turn people off. You know, there's a way of asking and accepting, and then there's a way of sort of being obnoxious about it. And I think, I can't tell you how I managed to do it. When I look back on it, I think, boy, I really, as I use the word chutzpah, I really.
Yes, for sure.
I really did. You know, I didn't. And there's some stuff that's not even in the book, because there was a limit to how negative I wanted to be about some of the people that everybody knows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like some of this stuff that some of these questions you've answered during our thing. Yeah. So who were your key role models and mentors?
Well, I guess the person who really got this whole thing started was Florence Hazeltine. She was the one that was at the National Institute for Child and Maternal Health. And she is an OBGYN. I think she's at the University of Texas now. But she really started the society because, as I said, she recognized that nobody was paying attention to women's health issues. So, you know, I certainly wouldn't have gotten involved if it wasn't for her. And if it wasn't for her recognizing this, I mean, there was actually, though, and it turns out in doing research, that there had been a paper previous to the work that we had done, basically stating that research on women was not being done at the NIH. So it was a paper that came out, but nobody paid any attention to it. And we found out when we were doing all this research and starting the organization that there actually had been, which would actually, again, this is going back, was one of the reasons we were able to do this, because the paper had been issued, I don't know if it was called paper or whatever, showing that women were not being focused on in terms of research, when we were in clinical trials and stuff. So when we were able to, we had to investigate the NIH. And the only way you could investigate the NIH, this I learned also, was you can't say you should have been doing this. You can investigate them if they were told they should do it and they weren't doing it. So we went to Congress and got members of Congress to write a letter to the GAO investigating the NIH based on that initial paper.
Wow.
And the answer came back, nothing. And then we did the same thing for the FDA. So again, you know, as all this is coming back to me, there were lots of different steps that occur that allowed us to get from, you know, one.
Yeah, and so many people that are in your book that you mentioned, you give tribute to so many different people that we can't talk about now. But so Florence Hazeltine was key, though. So what do you hope your legacy will be?
Well, I hope this, you know, I'm excited, you know, that everybody is taking, you know, is talking about the book. I'm hoping that things will, you know, it's I won't be around for this, but all this precision medicine and AI and technology is going to change the way a lot of things obviously are being done. And I think, you know, in terms of the social determinants of health and the fact that, you know, minority populations haven't gotten the care and the attention that they should, that with assuming everybody can do technology and, you know, let's have broadband and stuff, but eventually I guess everybody will. I think it'll be easy to do clinical trials. It certainly will be easier for women. They won't have to worry about, you know, child care and traveling and stuff. So I do think, you know, the world as we know is really changing. And I think that it will make it, I think there's more education, hopefully, about what clinical trials are. I hope young physicians and young researchers are paying attention. So I hope this book will stir. I would love it to be in the curriculum of some schools.
Yes.
I'm actually speaking. I was invited to speak, I think, next week or the week after Johns Hopkins. And so I really think that it needs to be in the curriculum. And there's going to be an audio and a Kindle so, you know, people can access it.
Well, I do have to tell you that I thought it was going to be a snoozer, to be honest. Like, so when I asked you for a copy of the book, I'm like, all right, maybe I shouldn't read this at night. I'm going to have to fall asleep. But it was a great read. Like, seriously, look at all my tabs in here of what I found interesting. Like, you know, this is just, it's a terrific book, right? And you could have gotten bogged down in so many things, but the story, it just reads really quick and it's interesting. So many, you know, so many things I didn't know and learned by reading the book, and I'm not in the medical profession.
Well, and
so.
I have to put a shout out for Kalia Dona, who worked with me on it. If you look at the footnotes of the citations, God, you know, I mean, you know, never in a million years could I have done that.
Yeah, no, it's a great book. And I hope, you know, I hope that it does get lots of exposure and it's an important subject. And we're going to wind down now. But this is the extraordinary Phyllis Greenberger. Thank you, Phyllis, for being on here. It was great learning about your career and your book and everything that you've done. And good luck with the book. And thank you to Seeking the Extraordinary, the Colony Group. The Colony Group's a national wealth and business management company with offices across the country that itself seeks the extraordinary as it pursues its unrelenting mission of providing clients with peace of mind and empowering their visions of tomorrow. To learn more about the Colony Group and how it manages beyond money, visit thecolonygroup.com. You can also follow us on LinkedIn and on Twitter @Colony Group. For Seeking the Extraordinary, I'm Christina Saunders. Thank you.